Bitcoin and crypto have never really had to compete with marginal liquidity like it has in this cycle, because the liquidity call or the requirements to finance the IPOs is not as big as what the headline suggests. I don't think that in and of itself should be of great concern to the markets. It's really what's happening with treasury liquidity that is, I think, the thing that I am most concerned about.
Jamie Coutts blends traditional finance with digital assets through a data-driven, multidisciplinary approach. From leading crypto research at Bloomberg Intelligence,
he now serves as chief crypto analyst at Real Vision, democratizing high-quality crypto insights for investors in the on-chain economy.
Bitcoin is down 50%. Global liquidity is at all-time highs. If we break this sort of 58 level, I think lower 50s is where you'll find the real support. Investing in Bitcoin is understanding the frailties of the current fiat liquidity framework, and also understanding that all roads lead to greater and greater liquidity.
Hey guys, I hope you've been enjoying the episodes I've been putting out as much as I do. For me, it's been a great journey with less noise, more signal, talking to all these experts all the time. With each and every episode, I feel like I have new points to ruminate on, things to ponder over. And yeah, I've just been learning so much. So if it's the same for you, I'd appreciate you subscribing to the show on YouTube, also commenting with the episodes when you have something to say, like it and share with your friends and families and colleagues. That would be much appreciated. And that way we could reach more people with this great content and grow together. So thanks a lot for doing this. Much appreciated. And yeah, let's go. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal. Today joining me is Jamie Coutts once again. It's good to have you with us, Jamie.
It's good to be back, Pascal. Thanks, man.
Yes, great. So it was time to get you back on. I mean, we had you on about Q3 of last year, I think, and that was a very timely and interesting show, because I was just going back to the show and I figured that you were one of the only ones kind of flagging the alarm bell, you know, or sound the alarm bell about what's coming. You know, liquidity is receding, and you were kind of cautious back then. And looking back from it, from like right now, you know, in retrospect, that was quite a good call. So I thought I need to get you back on to kind of figure out where we're at right now. So amazing, yeah.
Yeah, it's bittersweet though. I remember the podcast, and I was flagging liquidity in mid Q3 and then in the early Q4, but like, I think we were speaking in September, but it was the liquidity situation, which was obvious going to become a problem in Q4. And then there was the technical indicators and the massive bearish divergence on the weekly RSI, which is a pattern I've seen play out over equities for two decades that really had me concerned. And I say it's bittersweet because I de-risked the portfolio a little bit. I mean, I'm a long-term investor, so my core positions are my core positions. But in the research, you know, I de-risked and flagged it, and I thought 30% decline. But what we had is, I think, legitimately the top of the cycle. And we're still now working our way through the other side of that, which is, you know, a prolonged bear market, or you could say just, you know, your normal Bitcoin bear markets, which tend to average about 9 to 12 months. So we're still working our way through that at the moment. And Bitcoin's sort of trading 62,000. We touched 58 in the last couple of days. So we retested the February 6, 7 capitulation low. And, you know, from all accounts, I don't think we're done yet on the downside. So, well, we've still got a little bit to go. But it's bittersweet because, you know, I would have liked to have de-risked the portfolio a little bit more than I did.
Yeah, I mean, that happens to the best of us. I mean, I can speak to this as well. I mean, I manage money as well at the bank that I'm working with, and I also de-risk de-risk more, like you just said. You know, it's always the case with Bitcoin, because it can also go, yeah, once you're caught on the wrong foot, so to say, then it can go against you, know. So yeah, but at least we've seen it coming, and like we're learning, I guess, as we go along here. So I'd love to learn some more from you. So How are you assessing the current situation? You know, we have the IPOs coming up that everybody is freaked out about, and there's like this narrative floating around. Bitcoin is being sold off just to participate in that narrative. And from what I can see, working at the bank, you know, the Swiss bank, we get a lot of requests of people wanting to join that IPO, even though like in Switzerland, it's probably, it's no, you won't be able to do so because everything is, the whole music is playing in the US. But then that's what we're seeing, you know, and we have MicroStrategy, you know, messing around a little bit and spooking the market, and Bitcoin, like chart-wise, you already said it, it's in a downtrend. So how are you assessing the entire situation right now?
Well, I definitely think that the rotation is happening, but it's been happening since Q4 last year. So there's obviously a confluence of things that happened in Q4. There was the Federal Reserve was still tightening its balance sheet at that time, which was the thing that I was flagging in September, saying this can't continue. And they pivoted in early December, but there's also the Binance deleveraging event, rug pull, whatever you want to call it, that I think just essentially killed, nuked the market structure, a lot of major players, and took out all the leverage. But that was also the quarter that, you know, I think it was Opus 4.6, which was really the step change model for the LLMs. And the realization that the agentic era wasn't farcical, that it was now starting. And then we had open, you know, Claude Bot and Open Core, the new iterations of that all sort of start in early January. But that AI scarcity or AI build out trade really accelerated in Q4. And look, I think, you know, as those sort of confluence events happen in Q4 and then an unwind of a huge amount of derivatives positioning, there was a huge build up in leverage. Like a lot of my cycle top indicators, again, like I was flagging in September, were, you know, we're starting to register that, you know, open interest was accelerated, you know, versus the market cap, and funding rates were also elevated as well. So that was sort of a clear signal. And so once the unwind happens, then you get, you know, a lot of follow through. And so that all happens. Meanwhile, over in, you know, this much larger market being US tech, there is a legitimate story around AI disrupting and huge potential earnings growth in anything related to the AI build out that is sucking capital out of Bitcoin and crypto. So, I mean, capital goes to where it's treated best. And even though global liquidity has been expanding throughout in aggregate, you know, X that period in December or in Q4 last year when it was contracting, it still expanded all throughout this year. But, you know, the thing is that Bitcoin and crypto have never really had to compete with marginal liquidity like it has in this cycle, because AI simply wasn't around in the last cycle. And each marginal unit of liquidity is now chasing the best returns. And it's just been momentum, but also based on really strong fundamentals that it's been flowing into AI. So I think it's true. I think it's true that there is rotation happening, but it's also, you know, Bitcoin's been in a bear market for, you know, the best part of 9 months or thereabouts. And we are approaching levels, which I would argue for long-term accumulators is really in sort of what I call the value zone or an accumulation zone. But there is definitely there's some clouds on the horizon that the market will need to work through. The IPO, like the liquidity call or the requirements to finance the IPOs is not as big as what the headline suggests. Like we're not at levels seen in 1999 or even 1996 was like the highest level for IPOs as a percentage of the market cap of the S&P. It's elevated, but it's not at record highs. So in gross and nominal terms, yes, $250 billion this year is a large number, but percentage of market cap, maybe not so much. But it's really what's happening with treasury liquidity that is, I think, the thing that I am most concerned about, in that next year is just a huge refinancing year. It's the largest on record. It's about $400 billion more than this year. And it's a lot of refinancing of debt that occurred in 2020 to 2022 at much lower rates. So I think that has to be managed by the Treasury. I don't know how it's going to go. It could be bumpy.
Yeah, thanks a lot for this overview. That's great. I think I want to get into some of the stuff that you mentioned later on in the episode, also the macro stuff, the refinancing. Well, you even prepared some slides, but let's maybe stick with Bitcoin in the meantime. You know, I want to ask you, like there's this AI trade, you know, that's kind of picking or nagging at Bitcoin, you know, and Bitcoin is, yeah, as you said, you know, maybe losing some traction vis-a-vis AI. But then also, what about Sailor and Strategy? What do you think? To what extent or how much is Sailor responsible for what's happening right now?
It's definitely having an outsized impact, I would think. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword when you've got corporates or you've got large players now who hold a large part of the supply. And Sailor's, you know, strategy has been sort of a game of cat and mouse with capital markets. And we're sort of at the next phase of that cat and mouse game. So we will find out tonight, I think. You know, by the time this podcast comes out, it'll be old news. So whether it's the MicroStrategy shareholders that get screwed, whether it's Bitcoin holders that get screwed, or whether it's Stretch, I think it's either going to be Bitcoin or MicroStrategy holders that end up getting it in the neck. But hopefully, I don't know. I really don't know which is the best resolution of this problem, whether it's just like a massive sale of Bitcoin, but that would just fly in the face, I guess, of their mantra. But someone is going to have to take it on the chin. I find it a little bit annoying, to be honest. I mean, I hate watching what the Fed says and trying to interpret their cryptic messaging. And now we have to sort of wait for tweets from Sailor and about, you know, potentially what he's going to do. So it is what it is. And as I said, it's a double-edged sword.
That's the irony of it all. And that's well said. I mean, in the end, exactly. Like a lot of Bitcoiners have also, like rightly so, been critical of Fed watching, you know, and everyone is sort of glued to the lips of Powell, and now it will be Warsh. But I mean, we have the same with Sailor, you know, and some people have already kind of said so, you know, like Strategy is sort of the Bitcoin central bank by now. And I mean, yeah, it's been happening over the years. He's just been amassing so many Bitcoins, and people have been rightly critical of that. But I mean, in the end, it's just like a natural force. You can't really do anything about it, you know, because he figured out Bitcoin and it's his own right to do so. But I mean, you're right. I mean, you know, it's going to be tough what he will be doing. Like a lot of people were hoping for tonight is the thing that you mentioned, the announcement that he's coming out and telling the market that he sold a bunch of Bitcoin over the weekend or last week, you know, and now has like a huge USD reserve to make sure he can cover all the annual dividend payments that we'll have to cover in a fixed US dollar amount. But I guess we might even see him announcing that he bought more Bitcoin. And yeah, it's all going to be tough. I mean, currently the market is not that fond of him, and it's probably yet another period that we Bitcoiners have to go through. In the long dated view, I guess. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'd prefer it to be MicroStrategy holders based more so, you know, if I had to speak my own book. But I guess in the best case scenario from my perspective, hypothetical, is that he's found the other side of that trade. If he is going to sell Bitcoin, that he's lined up a large buyer to do basically an OTC equivalent of an ATC.
Ah.
So it doesn't go through the market. So it'll be fascinating. I don't think it's going to be that generous towards Bitcoin holders, but we'll see.
But any thoughts on like him capitulating and potentially even going bankrupt? I mean, that's a lot. People are like genuinely worried about this. Is this another sort of quantum fault, you know, that Bitcoin now is really sort of at the lower end of its price? You know, and that's why people are freaking out about it. And maybe it's actual FUD, and it will just be that he will have to sell some Bitcoin, but it won't be that he will be going bankrupt. Or like, how are you viewing the situation?
Well, I mean, you know, most things aren't FUD. Like there's a distribution of probabilities that allows for that to happen. It's extremely small. I mean, Bitcoin was to drop back to sort of 5,000, I think that's a threshold that would mean that he would, but it's extremely unlikely. So I'm not as concerned about that, but I just generally feel a lot more uncomfortable now that we've got this concentration, and you know that this does get, I guess, you know, this goes around the market. This is a topic of discussion all the time, and whilst it's a low probability, there's always a chance that something extreme could happen. There's nothing certain in markets. As much as we believe in Bitcoin and the long-term potential of the asset, there's a whole host of probability of distribution of the probabilities that does allow for things that we don't expect to happen. But yeah, I think it's a very low probability because, you know, he can basically sacrifice Stretch, you know, at the expense of everything else. But yeah.
No, you're right. Yeah, in the end, I mean, I guess people were just sort of disappointed that Saylor has again and again just not kept his word. You know, it was back then with the MNAV, you know, that he said he's not going to issue any more stock, and then he did. And now he was so adamant about not selling your Bitcoin, and now he sold, which I always thought, like, why be so adamant about these type of things? You know, because markets, they're just relentless, you know, and they're going to test you on this. And so maybe you keep your mouth shut and not have these high create these high expectations of yourself. And so, but it's probably, yeah, it's Saylor's human after all as well. And wherever humans are, like, faults are being made, you know?
Yeah. And he's also the CEO. I mean, I can understand on one side why selling Bitcoin could be advantageous long-term, especially if he's able to get those Bitcoin off the books to a large buyer that doesn't impact the market. That would be unbelievable because it does give MicroStrategy a higher chance of index inclusion, because one of the things that was one of the things the index providers were discounting MicroStrategy about was the fact that they wouldn't sell this one asset, which was, you know, a non-yielding asset and non-productive asset. And so, like, longer term, if it was included in the S&P 500, a lot of the major indices, index families, then that would be ultimately good for the ecosystem and good for the asset. But, you know, it's a company. At the end of the day, they have a different set of fiduciary responsibilities, and it's also, you know, he's a human, so it just introduces more complexity. But that, maybe you could argue that was always going to be the case, and the natural progression of the asset through to its eventual conclusion was that these companies, someone else was going to do it if it wasn't for Saylor, and this is just how it goes. And you take your lumps as a Bitcoin holder, you know, for the progression of the asset and the way it's mapping out.
No, then you're right. If you're sort of a Bitcoin realist, I think that was a very likely scenario that at some point somebody would run the Saylor trade just because it makes sense. I mean, Saylor just does what we have done for years, you know, buy Bitcoin because it's appreciated that much. And he now just took it to an extreme and does financial engineering on top of it. But we'll see how it all develops and turns out. But maybe we can turn to Bitcoin and its price, you know, because before we started the show, you said you have your own models, and you mentioned them as well already during the show. So what are they showing right now? What are you looking at specifically? If you could maybe share your screen, that would be great.
Yeah, look, happy to. One of the things that, you know, I've used throughout my career is a technical analysis discipline. And so I think price is, you know, price distills everything. Price is truth. So even, like, you know, this year, as liquidity was sort of rising, but price was breaking down, that was a very clear signal that liquidity, you know, in as much as how it's held or how it's related to price in previous cycles, had deteriorated. And I ran regressions on this as well. And I was, I was actually publishing this in research in Q3, that if you look at Bitcoin over the cycles, the relationship to global liquidity and various subsets of liquidity metrics that people tend to use, like global M2, but, you know, I use global liquidity, which is a culmination of several different liquidity metrics, but they kind of tell the same story. The problem is that relationship has been deteriorating over the years, especially since, you know, 2022. Interestingly, in that very same period, the NASDAQ, which is also highly correlated, all risk assets are correlated to global liquidity, which makes total sense, but the NASDAQ correlation has actually been increasing. So, you know, you don't even have to get caught up in too much of the narratives. You can just say statistically that global liquidity in this cycle has, you know, related to a higher or a stronger relationship with NASDAQ or tech stocks. And of course, we would argue that that's because AI came along and was so strong and such a transformative, the most transformative technology in the world. Yeah, of course it did. But, like, statistically, you can prove that out as well. And the elasticity is also another way of measuring it as well. So for every new dollar of liquidity, how much has that traditionally impacted the Bitcoin price? And so that was used to be, you know, it ranged from around sort of 7 times to even up to 20 times in raging bull markets like 2017. But that collapsed in this cycle as well. And it's down considerably. In fact, it's the lowest it's ever been. And that's, you know, clear because Bitcoin is down 50%. Global liquidity is at all-time highs. So, you know, the price is the ultimate sort of guide if you're trying to tactically invest in the asset and ignore the long-term trajectory of the asset. But you can see here that I've built this up trading indicator. I just call it Trend Chameleon because it just simplifies a couple of momentum and trend indicators into colors. Pretty simple to sort of observe, but you can see that, you know, we are in a strong bear trend on the weekly chart. And I use the weekly chart because that's just a better gauge for the, you know, the inflection points of like structural or cyclical turns. And it worked really well in the last cycles. It was the cornerstone of what I was using in 2022. That called the bottom in December of 2022. And so we've got that plus an RSI on the bottom as well. And RSI very rarely dips below 30 on the weekly, except near lows, but not always at the low. And I pointed this out in, you know, the February research when we hit that capitulation low, was that yes, we've dipped below on the RSI, and you know, that is a level that will get a lot of people interested, as will the 200-week moving average, which is now touching, you know, as a level to get interested. And yes, that's why I say like it's in the accumulation zone, but typically Bitcoin tends to take, you know, more time to resolve after that first flush down. There's usually a second flush. And I think we're in that play right now, especially when you consider that, you know, you've got a lot of refinancing to do that's going to need more liquidity. And we've got a Fed that wants to shrink the balance sheet. So, you know, we've got all those things to contend with.
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes.
Yeah, the RSI is a very interesting tool to use. I mean, that's what you were saying. I heard other people point this out as well, you know, that usually like you have this low on the RSI and then you have a Bitcoin low, but then maybe price can even go lower, like, but then the RSI might just put in a lower high, you know, at that point, even though the price, again, as you mentioned, might even go lower than it was on the first low with the RSI. And then, but that would all be already be sort of a bullish divergence then, right? Pointing to some sort of exhaustion price-wise or market-wise, which could be interpreted as bullish. And on the other side, again, you can also have these bearish divergences. Is that also the way you're looking at?
At that. Yeah, I mean, it's evident in the price structures of the previous lows that there was a huge flush down, and then either a retest or a new low, but corresponding with a higher low on the RSI. And the RSI is just like momentum. Momentum has like an upper and lower limit. So when you're looking at it in a relative perspective, like, the rate of change can't continue to go in the same direction forever. It starts to moderate, and that's what the RSI is picking up. So price can do what it can do. It can extend, it can go further, but in terms of the veracity of that move losing strength or losing some of its thrust, for lack of a better word, it doesn't say that's the bottom, that's the inflection point, but it's a signal, it's a sign that the sellers are getting exhausted. And so you can see that the RSI here is still, you know, much higher than where it was in February, but we're right at those lows. So I would like to think that this would be a normal sort of bear market formation, a bear market low formation, where we do get a bullish divergence on the RSI with a, you know, a lower low on a Bitcoin from here. And that would be typically normal. And it would be like the first sign of a setup for a reversal, because the ability for the market to push as hard as it did in February to a new low is weakening. And then you use other things on the other side on the way up. Now, this is a weekly chart, so it's going to miss the low by 20-25% typically, because it's a very slow moving momentum indicator. But you can, you know, drill down into the dailies to see that play out if you want to sort of try to be a bit more technical. But you get a lot more whips in that indicator. So I tend to use different time frames together, but I certainly wouldn't use this in isolation. I've got exhaustion indicators like DeMarc and various other ones that I've built that, you know, put together, give me sort of try to give me at least a higher probability, you know, trade when the cycle does turn. And some of those are on-chain, the on-chain data as well, and futures data. So I'll show you this as well, Pascal, because I mean, whether you're looking at MVRV, you know, the pure multiple, perps, open interest, the long-term holder, SOPRA, the whatever, there's a bunch of them, right? And I just use, you know, Z scores on all that data to try and normalize it. We're definitely in this zone where typically, if you've got like a 2-year view, 18 months to 2-year view, generally you've done really, really well in these levels. But, you know, We try to overthink it.
That's great. I mean, these indicators just give a full picture. Like, people obviously now ask the question as well. Like, yeah, I get it. You know, price can potentially move lower. I'm maybe even positioned for this, but then how low can it actually go? You know, and obviously nobody knows. But like, if we look to prior cycles, or if we confront some of the models that you're using here, what would they tell you? Is there any indication like, okay, this could be where the lower low could be at, you know, price-wise? Is there something you can point to, like a zone of confluence or like price-wise?
Yeah, look, I haven't done enough work on that, actually, to be honest. But look, if we looked at previous bears, and everyone will quote the nominal percentage drawdown, which, you know, like as the 4-year cyclists were kind of right in a very sort of, you know, let's face it, it's a pretty simplistic, dumb model that really shouldn't work.
Given
the change of the market structure and the players and everything else. But hey, it did.
Yet it does.
You can say that, right? Well, the drawdowns have been sort of 75 to 80% prior. So that's where we should look. But then if you look at the volatility of the asset, the volatility has compressed. So the 50% decline that we're in today is definitely of the magnitude of previous bear markets, if you volatility adjust it. But that doesn't mean that it can't go lower and give us the same nominal. But if I had to guess, I think, you know, if we break this sort of 58 level, I think lower 50s is where you'll find the real support. Like the should be a market low around then. But look, if Saylor's dumping Bitcoin in unsized, and he's not able to find the other side of that, and he's going to market on it, then, you know, it's the thing that we didn't, you know, most people didn't anticipate, like FTX in 2022, right? That just pushed it below, I think, what was a natural support level at sort of like 18,000-19,000, and pushed it down to 16,500 very quickly. And it, you know, that was the ultimate low. But that the trending indicators will tell you when, because they'll start to break out on the other side. So you know, it's kind of like trying to catch a falling knife right now.
I mean, that's exactly it. You know, a lot of people are asking themselves this question because they're looking at these models as well, and they're coming to a similar conclusion than you do. Like, okay, you know, it looks like Bitcoin is already at the lower price target. It's in very favorable territories right now, so it shouldn't, historically speaking, go any lower from here, or not that much lower. But then again, people look to the macro sphere, you know, they look at what's happening with strategy. They're looking at, as I say, macro, and they're like, okay, but there could still be some headwinds, you know, coming our way. And what would Bitcoin do if the traditional market, which looks kind of toppy as well? Some people say, you know, maybe if the AI trade slows down, and then what if it corrects another 20%? Will we find it in the 40s, in the 30s? And so, yeah, I mean, that's the trillion-dollar question. So how do you think about this? And maybe can you point us to some of the headwinds that you were already mentioning in the beginning, you know, with the AI and the refinancing wall? And yeah, maybe you can talk to this as well, because I know you've prepared some slides for this as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that the market structure is evolving. Like, I don't think it's static. I think that AI is in many ways a driver for Bitcoin because, you know, what does AI do to the terminal value of most companies? I think that is actually very, very favorable for Bitcoin. I think the changes in market structure or the regulations and the push from the US Treasury for stablecoin issuance to somewhat finance the US government, but also keep their sort of currency primacy around the world is extremely bullish for blockchain assets and companies leaning into blockchain, especially because they will extract the most efficiencies and have the value accrual mechanisms that most people understand through earnings growth rather than on the token front. But I'm still bullish on, you know, blockchain tokens themselves or certain ones to be in a basket for the long term due to all these market structure and regulatory changes. So these are all sort of very big tailwinds. And like it's been said by probably many of your guests, but like we've never seen the tailwinds line up for the asset class en masse like we do right now. But the one thing I'll say is that we're in this very weird spot where most people can see the agentic future coming pretty fast, but it's not showing up on chain yet, right? We're not seeing the transactions. We're not seeing the activity that sort of justifies the thesis, although I'm pretty confident in the thesis. So I think for most traditional investors or just, you know, investors who haven't yet looked at the space, they'll wait for these things to be catalyzed and to be self-evident rather than sort of the hypothesis before capital moves in. But when it does, I don't think anything is going to stop that train. I think it's going to be one of the biggest trades. And what I might also say before I get onto the refinancing issue, which is the featured in the last report at Real Vision, is that I think I've got this sort of feeling that in crypto, the day is very clear. High inflation tokens with large vesting schedules underperform. And the flip side is low inflation and near fully or fully vested just tend to outperform. If you look at it from a research perspective, which I've been spending quite a bit of time on, like what actually works in crypto. And there's been a couple tokens that have been actually been doing rather well during the bear market the last couple of months. And these are tokens that have got or worked out a better value accrual mechanism back to the underlying token. For the longest time, the inflation rates and the vesting had just suppressed whatever demand came through on the token. It meant that tokens ran, they had bull markets, but they were very short-lived because the supply equation was so skewed the other way. And I think with clarity, being focused on reporting and transparency and insider holdings, and just institutional capital coming in and going, looking at the space and going, you know, why are you paying 7% inflation or emission rates to your validators to secure the network? That's just a hypothetical. And I think that means that, you know, all the 10 years of high inflation and VC vesting shenanigans is going to dramatically improve. And that means better returns for the underlying tokens. But in the same time, you've got equities which don't have any of that baggage, and I think they'll do very well. So they're all the tailwinds. Now, that wins.
Yes, and exactly. Yeah, I mean, if you could pull up your slide deck, you know, because I think you prepared one, and maybe you can talk to some of them. I guess if you could move to slide 3 of your slide deck, that would be cool, because there you're also kind of dispelling that myth, which I found quite interesting, you know, that the IPO supply is rather noise than signal. You know, everybody's talking about the IPO supply and how much liquidity it will kind of demand. And yeah, you had some interesting perspective on that.
So in terms of nominal numbers, we're, you know, equivalent to 2021, but let me just bring up this.
Yeah, that would be good.
So this chart is just breaking down the IPO calendar, and hang on, I'll just expand this so it's a little bit clearer. So in nominal terms, this has obviously got three parts to the chart, but I would just draw your attention to the top chart, which is just the gross or nominal proceeds from the IPO sales. And so if you think about 2026 and 2027 together, in gross numbers, they're the largest two-year period of IPO issuance. So from a headline perspective, that is obviously very, very meaningful. In the below chart, you've got the real proceeds, so price in sort of $2026, and then the share of market cap. They're not as extreme as we've seen in the past. You know, the highest IPO year when you consider IPOs as a percentage of market cap was actually 1996. And we had a very thick IPO issuance period from 1995 all the way through to 2000. So, you know, I don't think that in and of itself should be of great concern to the markets. It's really about what's happening on the treasury market side. And I've got in this report for Real Vision, I look at the investment grade debt issuance as well. It's elevated when you think about the amount of issuance relative to the size of investment grade debt or the pool of investment grade debt. It's sort of at elevated levels. Again, I don't think that in isolation is something that we need to be overly concerned with. It's definitely a factor. What becomes a problem is when you've got these two things dovetailing into 2027, which is the highest US Treasury issuance year. So US Treasury issuance rises from $3.3 trillion to $3.7, and it's a big step up that the market's got to absorb. And a lot of the refinancing that's going to take place in next year is, you know, debt that obviously was taken out in 2020, 2021, 2022. If you look at sort of the average maturities, 5 or 6 year period, and that needs to be absorbed. And we can talk about, you know, what the Treasury strategy is. They're not dummies. They're aggressively managing the maturity of their issuance and strategies around this. But you can't deny that that is quite a big that's quite a big lift.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, you have on slide 7, like, as you said, gross financing needs as a percentage of GDP. I mean, they're elevated, but not at crisis levels from what I can gather, right? But then again, this can potentially force liquidity. And I'd be interested to know, like, who could potentially be forced, you know, to provide that liquidity? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, the way that they can, they're obviously pushing more into the short end they're using the banks to monetize the debt. And so there's been, I think, around $250 billion added just since sort of February through that strategy of changing the supplemental leverage ratios. They obviously want stablecoin take up to increase dramatically to soak up more of that issuance as well. But interestingly, stablecoin issuance has been growing, but it really slowed over the last 12 months. Stablecoin transfer volumes have grown over the last 12 months, but are down in terms of that growth. It's really the only area of the on-chain data that has actually grown substantially over the year, but it has slowed. So that needs to, you know, accelerate, which is why, you know, the government needs clarity to get passed so that can really step up. But they've got, you know, I'm sure they're talking to international partners about, increasing demand or increasing purchases of US longer term debt. You know, whether that's from Japan or from, you know, the Middle East, who knows? And maybe they're talking to China to try and work on a deal here where they can take some of the debt in return for certain other privileges or favors. Who knows? But like, they're no doubt, you know, like super sensitive or aware and are trying to work it through. But, you know, the point of the research was just to highlight that is it's a step change that needs to be absorbed. Usually what happens if you use up the capacity of the market in an issuance schedule like that, like rates would have to rise, but they can't afford rates to rise because interest burden as a percentage of GDP is at or now reaching all-time highs, around about 3.2%. So they need to manage it for sure. We're just in a position right now where Warsh is out communicating that he wants to shrink the balance sheet. And you know, if they can pull that off, it will be the greatest, you know, fiscal monetary masterstroke of all time. How they can manage to shrink the balance sheet while facing a massive the biggest refinancing wall, you know, in their history.
It's almost as if we're back to strategy, you know, where we discussed that something will have to give. You know, somebody will be left holding the bad bag, so to say. And here as well, I mean, we have the Fed in front of us. We hear what they're communicating, but then again, you know, they have only these many levers to pull. And one of them is, as you said, I think it's on slide 8, you know, where you said Treasury, they can skew the issuance to the front end. You know, it's probably what they have been doing for quite some time. But then again, you know, we have the banks who are absorbing. And the last point, I think, is also quite interesting. You know, the authorities, like, they're trying to suppress collateral market volatility, like the MOVE index. You know, I think that's something Michael Howell also has been talking about for quite some time. So why is that important in your view? Like, how does it help, you know, by suppressing collateral market volatility? And how does that help kind of better the liquidity picture?
Well, it's through the multiplier effect. So, you know, all the debt in the system is being repoed and lent out, and that's financing the global markets. If volatility spikes, then you need to take a haircut on the refinancing, and that is being actively managed, you know, through, I think, treasury buybacks and maybe measures that I'm not even aware of. But it's clear. And it's also like it become a, you know, a huge hedge fund trade as well. So I think that's, you know, these are all factors that are playing into like very unorthodox, sometimes like perhaps, you know, first ever management policies by the US Treasury and, you know, the Federal Reserve in ensuring that that volatility doesn't spike. But if you look at the MOVE index, we had that run up in February and March, but we made a higher low, and we haven't gone back down to where it was in January. So it's elevated, but it's not really at levels which would concern markets. But you know, it's what everyone's now acutely aware of, and that's why they're trying to manage it, because they know everyone is acutely aware of what it means now.
Yeah, that's a very important point. I mean, these collateral sort of, you know, mechanisms that play in today's markets, they're widely sometimes misunderstood, you know, and it's to people like Michael Howell and so that have pointed to this, you know, that it's so important that markets are this refinancing mechanism and not so much an interest rate mechanism. That's, I think, how he's called it. But then again, what I always found interesting is that, like, with these, also the reverse management operations that the Fed is currently doing, you know, by it's buying these bills, it's effectively removing bills from the ecosystem, so to say, you know, from the market, and providing reserves, which I was always wondering, well, is this actually liquidity enhancing, you know, because you're taking collateral out of the system, which potentially needs to be rehypothecated to provide liquidity. So, I mean, they're walking this very fine line, you know, of like, okay, how to actually provide liquidity in the first place. So I wouldn't want to be in their shoes. That's probably what I want to say with that, you know. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this.
Yeah, well, they're also, I mean, they're doing that on one hand, but then the Treasury has lifted or relaxed some of the SLR rules. So the banks can also now purchase these bills and lever them up on their balance sheet more than they have for the last 20 years. And that was always like the stated intention of the Trump or the Bessent Trump sort of administration, was to get credit growth happening again. And we're certainly seeing that. And it is, from an economic growth standpoint, paying off. But yeah, to your point, the credit-based fiat system, whatever you want to call it, is a very complex system, and the complexity is increasing. And that means that the measures and the levers they need to pull become more complex or more exotic. And, you know, they're just trying as many things now. Like, I mean, it was far more simple in the days of the QE era pre-2022, pre-Yellen really, at the Treasury, when it was just the Federal Reserve and they were just, you know, buying reserves. And that was like, you know, cocaine for financial markets. It didn't do much for the economy. And now we've got like this delicate dance where, you know, they wants to somehow like shrink the balance sheet in the face of, you know, expanding debt growth that is exceeding liquidity growth, which we all know will create tension in financial markets. It'll blow up one part of the, you know, the financial plumbing, and then they'll just have to come in and plug that hole. So yeah, it's I don't envy them either.
No, interesting. Can we maybe finish up again by summarizing, you know, what this now all means for digital assets, you know, this forced liquidity, why it is bullish, and then also potentially why, what could prove you wrong, you know, like what are things you are looking at to see, okay, maybe there's something will break first before there will be a forced liquidity, which will probably affect Bitcoin again, or how do you think about this going forward now?
Well, I think it'll be important to watch the messaging from Warsh as we go through the year. I mean, markets will look forward. So it's not like we roll into 2027 and they'll wake up to the refinancing, you know, issuance issue or problem. It'll start creeping in, I think, in the second half of the year as investment grade issuance increases from the hyperscalers and as these IPOs also drain, you know, marginal liquidity from the system or cause a rotation of liquidity in the system. So that, I think that's the thing I'm really looking at. And also if you look at just the bond volatility, the DXY auction spreads, things like that, to look for any sort of signs that there's tension starting to appear. Pretty standard stuff. I mean, I looked at the DXY today, it's still trapped in a 2-year range. So it's not showing anything too untoward, but if it did break above sort of like 101, I think that would be a breakout from a technical standpoint. It, like the MOVE index, has been fairly well contained or suppressed throughout this period. So these are sort of the markers that I'm looking for. But you know, investing in Bitcoin is understanding the frailties of the current fiat liquidity framework, and also understanding that all roads lead to greater and greater liquidity, you know, at the expense of savers in the economy. There's always one group that suffers, and you know, the release valve for it is, you know, is the destruction or the debasement of the currency eventually when things go too far in one direction. And that should continue to be very favorable for Bitcoin. And because part of the debasement strategy is stablecoins and the regulations to enable that, I think blockchain's utility over time increase dramatically, putting aside the, you know, woeful tokenomics that have sort of held back these assets, you know, over the last cycle. You know, over time, I think that just increasingly looks like a very suitable investment. Once you start layering in the agentic era, which the world is certainly not ready for, then you've got velocity of money moving through blockchains that will make everything, including like the meme coin eras of the past, look like nothing. And so that just feeds into the use case or the utility for blockchains as a legitimate investment class.
Great. Yeah. Thanks for these positive words to finish off here. I think let's wrap this up here. Thanks a lot, Jamie, again, for doing this. For anybody not in the know by now, like, how can they read more of your stuff and potentially reach out to you?
Yeah, so I'm part of the investment analyst team that produces independent research on the Real Vision platform. I'm on Twitter or X. The other one is at Real Vision.
That's great. Thanks a lot, Jamie. And yeah, talk to you soon again.
Thanks, Pascal. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Bye.